On the line with us right now is John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His most recent book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in Politics. And he has an article in The National Interest by the title of America Imperial by Design, and it's definitely something you should be checking out. We have a direct link to that at the front page of our website, as well as a direct link to where you can purchase his book directly from the publishers. Thanks so much for being on our show this morning, John.
My pleasure, Chuck.
It's great to have you on the show, and I'm hoping that we can spin this into a Stephen Walt interview in the near future, so I'll be bugging you about that. You write how, in the first few years after the Cold War ended, many Americans had a profound sense of optimism about the future of international politics. The basis of all this good feeling was laid out at the time in two famous articles. You mentioned the 1989 article, Francis Fukuyama argues in The End of History that Western liberal democracy had won a decisive victory over communism and fascism. And then you also mentioned this article by Charles Krauthammer, where he emphasized in his article, The Unipolar Moment, that the United States had emerged from the Cold War as by far the most powerful country on the planet. He urged American leaders not to be reticent about using that power to lead a unipolar world. U.S. grand strategy has followed this basic prescription for the last 20 years. Fukuyama, Krauthammer essentially argued that we won and we need to flex our muscles. In your opinion, why was Washington so willing to embrace this idea, and not just one side or the other, but seemingly both sides of the aisle?
Well, I think there's a deeply felt perception in the United States that we are a special nation. We are the city on the hill, and we, in effect, have a responsibility to go around the world and fix all the world's problems. I think this was best stated by Madeleine Albright in the 1990s when she was working for the Clinton administration. She said that America is the indispensable nation. She said that we stand taller and we see further. In other words, America knows what's best for everyone else. When you have that mentality, and then you have a lot of military force, and you think you can use that military force to do good around the world, there is no end of trouble that you're going to get yourself into. And, of course, that's why the United States is in so much trouble today.
And this didn't happen just because of 9/11. As you were saying, this is Madeleine Albright during the Clinton administration talking about this. So this isn't something that just happened on 9/11 and all of a sudden we changed direction. We were already moving in this direction, correct?
There's no question about that. I mean, the key to keep in mind is that the Democratic Party is by and large dominated by liberal imperialists. These are people who want to run around the world and reorder the politics of various countries to make those countries look like the United States. And the Clinton administration in the 1990s was filled with liberal imperialists. And by the way, many of those same people are now influencing policy in the Obama administration. The Republicans, on the other hand, don't have too many liberal imperialists, but they have neoconservatives dominating their thinking about foreign policy. And the neoconservatives, like the liberal imperialists, want to use American military force all around the world to remake the world in America's image. But the big difference between the liberal imperialists on one hand and the neoconservatives on the other is that the liberal imperialists want to run the world using international institutions more than military force, whereas the neoconservatives don't like international institutions. They prefer to do it with the big stick. But other than that difference in emphasis over means, their ends are basically the same. And that's why the Democrats and the Republicans basically look like Tweedledee and Tweedledum when it comes to the conduct of American foreign policy.
You were mentioning that quote by Madeleine Albright, and I bet that there are people out there who are in the listening audience who totally agree with Madeleine Albright, who believe that the United States is better than the rest of the world, that the United States is the lone superpower, that we're the wealthiest nation ever, that we have the greatest military of all time. So why shouldn't we be showing the rest of the world. Be kind to the rest of the world and show them how to have a great country like America. Why shouldn't we be doing that if that is the, you know, if that seems to be the way that the world is right now?
Well, it's not the way the world works. That worldview, which for sure many Americans share, is a fundamentally flawed way of thinking about international politics. And again, that's why we're in so much trouble. What one has to remember is that the most powerful political ideology in the world is not democracy. It's nationalism. And nationalism basically says that nation states or countries all around the world want to determine their own fate. All that's to say they believe in self-determination. And countries around the world don't like the idea of the United States coming in and telling them how to run their politics. They want to determine what their politics, what their economic policies look like for themselves. But the United States is almost incapable of understanding this basic fact of life because American leaders and the American public don't pay much attention to nationalism, and instead they talk endlessly about democracy. And the basic belief is that if we can just go spread democracy and make everybody look like us, everybody will love us. But the fact is that all of these other countries are not terribly happy about the United States interfering in their politics. And in some cases, you get a wicked backlash. And as you see in places like Afghanistan and in Iraq, and when I was much younger, this was true in Vietnam, that if there's one thing that countries around the world don't like, it's the American military paying them a visit and then staying there. And the end result is you get an insurgency and you get disasters like Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
So the foreign policy of both the Republicans and the Democrats, the foreign policy is one of global dominance. The Democrats is this liberal imperialism, and the Republicans have this neoconservatism. So basically, have you believe Americans have all signed off on, yes, we're all for global dominance as being the foreign policy that the United States exports around the world?
Well, there has always been a substantial slice of people who were not interested in global dominance, and I would put myself in that category for sure. But there are a lot of other people as well. It's just that inside the Beltway, the global dominators have dominated. But what's happened is that the end result of pursuing this grand strategy of global domination has led to so much trouble. Now lots of people are beginning to ask whether or not it's worth it. At some point, the Afghanistan and Iraq wars are going to end, and it's going to be clear to almost everybody that we lost. And Americans are going to be deeply disenchanted at that point. They're already disenchanted, but they'll be even more disenchanted once they see what pursuit of global dominance has led to. And then we'll probably cool our jets, to put it in colloquial terms, for a decade or two, much the way we cooled their jets after the Vietnam War. But eventually, this impulse to dominate the world will come back. And assuming that we're still a very powerful nation, 20 or 30 years from now, we'll probably get ourselves into more trouble.
Great. That's I'm really looking forward to that. You write that the founding fathers understood this problem of global dominance as it is clear from James Madison's observation that no nation can preserve its freedoms in the midst of continual warfare. Washington's pursuit of policies like assassination, rendition, and torture over the past decade, not to mention the weakening of the rule of law at home, shows that their fears were justified. Mark Danner, who was just on our show, he writes the New York Review of Books, "We have reached, when it comes to detainees, the opposite end of the spectrum from the presiding liberal idea of a government inherently limited in its powers." How much of the imperial design is caused by the imperial presidency that Arthur Schlesinger warned us about back in the 1960s? That is, first, that the U.S. presidency is out of control and that the presidency had exceeded the constitutional limits. How much of this is caused by this strong, what they call, a unitary executive theory?
There's no question that a powerful president or a powerful executive is the taproot of the problem here. But the question you have to ask yourself is, how did we end up with what is sometimes called an imperial presidency? And the answer is the Cold War. Up until 1947, when the Cold War got started, the United States had never had a powerful military in peacetime. Yes, we had a powerful military when we fought the Civil War, when we fought in World War I, and when we fought in World War II. But when those conflicts ended, we demobilized. And in peacetime, we had a very powerful military, which meant that we did not have a national security state. We did not have a military-industrial complex. We did not have a population where large numbers of people served in the military and became militarized. But that all changed with the Cold War. And the end result is that since 1947, the United States has had an imperial president, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican. The president has had lots of leeway in the realm of national security. And Congress and the public more generally have found it exceedingly difficult to put a brake on the president when he decides to go off and fight a war in Libya or in Iraq. But the real downside of this, and this gets at what Madison and Mark Danner were talking about, is that when you create a national security state, when you have a powerful peacetime military and you fight lots of wars, it ends up creating a situation where you begin to threaten civil liberties at home and where you begin to do terrible things abroad. And if you look at what the Bush administration did after September 11th, in terms of torturing people, in terms of extraordinary rendition, in terms of extrajudicial assassinations, it's really a depressing picture. And as long as we continue to fight these wars and think that we have a right and a responsibility to run the world, we're going to continue to pursue these deeply immoral policies. And furthermore, you're going to see civil liberties threatened at home. I think over the next 10 years, as more and more evidence appears about what the government did in the wake of 9/11, people are going to be shocked at the extent to which the government spied on us and did things that before 9/11 would have been considered completely unacceptable. So it's very important for Americans to understand that there is a significant price to pay for maintaining a national security state that fights wars all the time.
You're right.
And by the way, Chuck, if I can just make one quick point.
Go ahead.
Listeners should understand that the United States has been at war for 2 out of every 3 years since the Cold War ended. That's 14 out of 21 years, and there's no end in sight. So that probably the next time I appear on this show, I'll be able to say that we've been at war for 3 out of every 4 years. This is what Madison was worried about, and for good reason.
You write how after the failed nation building in Somalia in 1993, the Clinton administration became, quote, so spooked by the fiasco that it refused to intervene during the Rwandan genocide in the spring of 1994, even though the cost of doing so would have been small. By early 1998, the neoconservatives were pressuring Clinton to use military force to remove Saddam Hussein. The president endorsed the long-term goal of ousting the Iraqi leader, but he refused to go to war to make that happen. The United States under Bill Clinton was, as Richard Haass put it, a reluctant sheriff. That said, you were just saying how 2 out of every 3 years since the Cold War, we've been at war. For all his reluctance, Clinton did have military adventures in Haiti, twice in Serbia, Somalia. Should we be happy with a presidency that has as little, if you will, military engagements as Clinton did? Is that our new standard for wars? Just a few every 8 years ain't so bad?
Well, the truth is, if you had to choose between the Clinton administration's record and the Bush administration's record, you'd take the Clinton administration in a second.
Right.
There's no question that they used too much military force, and they were sticking their nose in places where it shouldn't have been stuck. But the fact is, they were very reluctant to use military force, and they were very cautious. And the end result is that we didn't have any disasters. But the Bush administration really kind of went off the deep end. And after they won what they thought was a spectacular victory in Afghanistan, they thought that gave them carte blanche to invade Iraq and then invade other countries in the Middle East. They thought that they had won this stunning victory in Afghanistan and had found the magic formula for winning wars all across the globe. Of course, they had not, as we found out in Iraq. And then, of course, we found out that they didn't really win the war in Afghanistan. It was just a temporary victory. And the Taliban eventually came back from the dead. And now we're up to our eyeballs and alligators there. But again, I take the Clinton administration over the Bush administration. But in a perfect world, I take neither administration, and I take one that's much less reluctant to use American military force, certainly for the purpose of doing social engineering in countries in the Middle East.
In what you call the protracted wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you write, the American military is not going to win either one of these conflicts, despite all the phony talk about how the surge has worked in Iraq and how a similar strategy can produce another miracle in Afghanistan. We may well be stuck in both quagmires for years to come in fruitless pursuit of victory. Two questions here that are kind of related. First, is it possible to win a war on terror where you defeat terrorism against the U.S. permanently? And second, if we can't, do you believe the U.S. should simply withdraw from both these wars now?
Well, first of all, the whole concept of a war on terror is ridiculous.
Right.
Terror is an instrument. I mean, how can you have a war on terror? As people like to say, it's like having a war on Blitzkrieg.
Right.
I mean, you could have a war against Nazi Germany or a war against Imperial Japan, but how do you have a war on Blitzkrieg? I mean, terrorism is a weapon that, certain actors use around the world when they're weak and have no other options. And if you're going to declare war on terrorism, you're going to be fighting all across the globe forever because terrorism is not going to go away. So I think one of the principal reasons that the United States got into trouble after September 11th was it defined the target as terrorism, which meant that we would be fighting all over the place and against threats that were not even aimed at us. And by the way, I recently saw an interview with Donald Rumsfeld reflecting on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, where he told the interviewer from BBC that he had told President Bush in the immediate aftermath of September 11th that it would be a mistake to label it a war on terror. But nevertheless, the Bush administration foolishly called it that. So I think we definitely have a war against Al-Qaeda, and the United States should go to great lengths to win that. But a global war on terror is a foolish idea in the extreme. Now, with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan, we should pull out of Iraq immediately. And we actually have an agreement there to get out at the end of this year. But we foolishly are trying to stay or keep some residual force there. Hopefully the Iraqis will tell us to get out completely, because that's what I'd prefer to do. And with regard to Afghanistan, I would pull out completely from there as well. The idea that we're going to win the war in Afghanistan or come up with some clever solution to the problems we face is a mirage. And we ought to just face up to that, cut our losses, and get out, much the way we did in Vietnam in the early 1970s.
You know what the argument is going to be, though, that will make it so America is less secure at home, because instead of, I'm using all these phrases that people who support the war use, because I think it's the best way to flesh out your ideas. Because if you say to, we are going to fight this war on terror over there so we don't have them fighting it here, do you believe that leaving Iraq or Afghanistan, why do you believe that wouldn't make the United States less secure here in domestically?
Well, I think that, first of all, the terrorists can use places besides Afghanistan and Iraq to plot and to train for missions against the United States. I mean, the plot that manifested itself in September 11th was basically hatched in Germany, and the training was here in the United States. The pilots who flew those aircraft into the buildings on September 11th learned to fly in the United States. They didn't design and train for this mission in Afghanistan. Furthermore, we have pushed Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan for all intents and purposes, and they just moved to Pakistan. And almost everybody agrees that if you're an Al-Qaeda operative, you're better off in Pakistan than you are in Afghanistan. So the fact of the matter is we could win the war in Afghanistan and it won't make a whit of difference because Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. And furthermore, Al-Qaeda operatives can train in all sorts of countries. this has basically been an intelligence and police problem from the beginning. And the idea that you have to run around the world invading countries like Afghanistan, Iraq to defeat al-Qaeda is simply wrong. And in fact, it makes the problem worse, not better, because it's quite clear from a lot of research that's been done on the causes of terrorism that the principal cause of terrorism is occupation. And if the United States occupies a place like Iraq, it's going to have a terrorism problem. If it stays out, it's not going to have a terrorism problem there. I would remind listeners that there was no al-Qaeda. There's no al-Qaeda in Iraq before we invaded. Saddam had the situation completely under control. And in fact, Saddam viewed al-Qaeda as an adversary. He was not joined at the hip with Osama bin Laden, as the Bush administration and the neoconservatives argued. He loathed Osama bin Laden. However, after we invaded the country and after we toppled Saddam Hussein, we were then confronted with al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. So what happened is you created an al-Qaeda cell in Iraq. So the best policy here is to stop invading and occupying countries. And furthermore, it would make a lot of good sense if we would put pressure on the Israelis to allow the Palestinians to have a state of their own and settle that conflict, because it's quite clear that that's another cause of our terrorism problem.
You know, I think I just thought of like a half dozen questions during that response. So let me see if I can get one of them out that seems a little bit clear. Last week, I was watching Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN, and he was interviewing Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense. And Rumsfeld was trying to point out why the Iraq War was a good thing to do. Even in retrospect, he still believes it was a good thing to do. He said, number one, al-Qaeda was already in Iraq because Zawahiri had actually traveled to Iraq. And he said, therefore, that means that al-Qaeda was in Iraq and therefore we should attack. And secondly, he said, you can't tell me now that the world isn't better off without Saddam Hussein, a brutal dictator who killed his own people. Let's say you were in that discussion with Donald Rumsfeld. How would you respond to those two remarks that show him supporting the Iraq War?
There was no al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. This is not to say that there weren't one or two people who were from al-Qaeda who might have moved into Iraq at one point of time or another, or and might have even moved into an area that Saddam Hussein didn't control. But the idea that Saddam Hussein was supporting al-Qaeda is ludicrous. We hear the same arguments today with regard to Iran. Those who want us to attack Iran make the argument that Iran is supporting al-Qaeda. This is not true. In fact, Iran helped us defeat the Taliban and wanted to work with us afterwards to help combat al-Qaeda. There's no close relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda, and there was no relationship of any sort between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, even if there was one person somewhere located inside the boundaries of Iraq. So Rumsfeld's argument is disingenuous. Is the world better off without Saddam Hussein? First of all, I believe Saddam Hussein was a murderous thug, and it's hard not to feel good about the fact that he's gone. If I were an Iraqi and I had a choice between living under Saddam Hussein after 2003 or taking the situation that we now have, I'd prefer to have Saddam Hussein. I think if you look at the destruction that we've wrought on Iraq, they were better off under Saddam Hussein. In terms of the American national interest, we'd be much better off today if Saddam Hussein were still in power. Again, I'm not saying that he wasn't a murderous thug, but removing him from power has not made America safer, or has not facilitated the development of a smart American foreign policy. And again, I think it would be a tough decision, but if I were an Iraqi and I was given a choice of voting as to whether to live under Saddam Hussein after 2003, three or not, I'd take Saddam Hussein.
We are speaking with John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His most recent book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in Politics. You can purchase that book by going to our website, clicking on the little link that says Oxford University Press, and you can purchase it directly from the publisher. One of the things that you point out is that during the foreign policy debate, I believe it is in 2000, between Gore and Bush, the way in which then candidate George W. Bush was portraying himself wasn't someone who sounded like he was neoconservative. He sounded like somebody who was interested in selective engagement with countries around the world and not just trying to force our military, not forcing our military on them and trying to bring democracy at gunpoint. Do you think that that changed on 9/11, or do you think that he was always a neoconservative and that he was just putting on this veneer of compassionate conservatism so he could win the election?
Well, Bush was an empty suit, right? It's hard to make the argument that he was seriously an X or seriously a Y. He never thought much about American foreign policy, even when he was running for president. He had spent most of his life partying, and then he was briefly the governor of Texas. But when he ran for the presidency in 2000, it was unthinkable for him as a Republican to run on the neoconservative platform, to argue that the United States should be even more interventionist than the Clinton administration had been. And indeed, what he did during the 2000 campaign, it's very hard to believe that this was the case for people who weren't around at the time, but Bush ran on the platform in 2000 that the Clinton administration had been overly ambitious in trying to reorder the world in America's image. And he said that we ought to, you know, pull back and concentrate on our traditional alliances and definitely not get involved in any more nation building. Of course, after September 11th, he ditched this strategy of selective engagement, this policy that called for pulling back our horns, and instead he adopted the neoconservative strategy, hook, line, and sinker, and went shooting off into Afghanistan, and then after that into Iraq, all in pursuit of remaking the entire Middle East at the end of a rifle barrel. So George Bush did a remarkable flip after September 11th, and he would have been much better off if he had stuck to the platform, the party platform that existed during the 2000 election.
You write that the ability of terrorists to strike the American homeland has been blown out of all proportion. In the 9 years since 9/11, government officials and terrorist experts have issued countless warnings that another major attack on American soil is probable, even imminent. But this is simply not the case. The only attempts we have seen are a few failed solo attacks by individuals with links to Al-Qaeda, like the shoe bomber and the underwear bomber. So we do have a terrorism problem, but it is hardly an existential threat, as the Bush administration has called it and others. In fact, it is a minor threat. Perhaps the scope of the challenge is best captured by Ohio State political scientist John Mueller's telling comment that, quote, the number of Americans killed by international terrorism since the late 1960s is about the same as the number killed over the same period by lightning or by accident causing deer or by severe allergic reactions to peanuts. But here's the problem. The government lives in fear of another attack. If there is one, not only will it be horrifically deadly, but it will also become a political liability for the sitting president. So while the real threat may be minor and not existential, the outcome would be devastating, not just in the number of people killed, but politically. But which do you think would more guides our war on terror? The reality of our security vulnerabilities or politicians simply cynically campaigning for votes?
Well, I think that for a variety of reasons, some of which you pointed out, most Americans and certainly most elites live in fear. We are a remarkably scared people. It's rather pathetic when you think about it. Basically, about 14 people have died from terrorist attacks by Muslims since September 11th, 14 people. Every year, 240 Americans drown from in their bathtubs. 240 Americans every year drown in their bathtubs. 14 Americans have been killed by Muslim terrorists since September 11th. We're worried about the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber. We're spending all this money and invading countries because this is the threat we face? This is ludicrous. I mean, do we have a problem? Yes. Is there a chance that we will get hit again? Yes. Is it likely that it will look like 9/11? No. Why are Americans so scared? It's just hard to understand. If you're going to run around the world with the American military killing people and using the big stick, you should expect people to occasionally retaliate against you. There is going to be a price to pay. But the fact is that that price is not very great. I don't want to diminish what happened on September 11th, but I do think that that was an exceptional case. We let our guard down, and it was truly disastrous what happened that day. But in the overall scheme of things, the disaster is not that great. And we're not now fighting Japan and Germany as we did after Pearl Harbor. We're fighting the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber. And the idea that we're scared stiff of these people and that we're, in effect, almost paralyzed is, again, it's ludicrous.
You know, and this will never happen again, I think, in your life. And I'm not trying to compare you to Ron Paul, but you said something that was similar to what Ron Paul, slightly similar to what Ron Paul said during a debate this week, where he was trying to give the reasons for the attacks on 9/11. And then Rick Santorum attacked him and said that the terrorists attacked us for our freedom, for our hope, for our because they hate our freedom, our hope, our democracy. What do people...
This is a bogus argument.
Right.
Simply not true.
Right.
There is a huge amount of survey data and anecdotal data which shows that they did not attack us for that reason. I mean, Rick Santorum and others can make that argument till they're blue in the face, but it is not true. They attacked us because they hate our policies. They hate the fact that we support Israel's brutalization of the Palestinians. They hate the fact that we had sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s that killed hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. They hate us because we have supported thugs like Hosni Mubarak in the Middle East for decades. They hate us because we occupied Saudi Arabia, which many al-Qaeda types considered to be sacrilegious. It was our policies that they hated. They don't hate us because of who we are.
But what happens? I mean, when you are saying to the American public, and you're trying to convince them that this is, you know, somebody like Rick Santorum is trying to convince the American public, they attacked us for our freedom, for our hope, for our opportunity, for our democracy. What do those people who eventually end up believing that, who want to believe that, what do they lose in their understanding of the world around us?
What do they lose?
Yeah.
Completely misunderstanding why we were attacked on September 11th. And if you're going to try to fashion a smart response to what happened on September 11th, you have to know what caused the events of that tragic day. I mean, we live in this bizarro world in America today where we can't have an honest discourse about what caused September 11th.
Yeah.
I would tell readers to go out and look at the 9/11 Commission report. There is no serious discussion in there of why we were attacked. And, of course, the reason that there's no serious discussion is because if we had one, it would conclude that we were attacked because of our policies. And then what would be very clear is that our support of Israel's policies towards the Palestinians is probably the key reason that we were attacked. And it's politically incorrect to say that. So instead, we purvey this false story that they attacked us because of who we are.
Yeah.
And by the way, Chuck, once you buy that argument that this is a case of them hating everything about the West, you're quickly reduced to making an argument that this is a clash of civilizations. And because we're not going to change who we are, we then have to go out and change who they are. This is what the Bush administration was all about. So you see, when you don't correctly answer the question, why do they hate us, you end up pursuing remarkably foolish policies. If we had answered that question correctly, and we had said it was our policies that they hate, and that's what caused 9/11, we would then have adjusted the policies, and we would have gone a long way towards solving this problem.
You also write that the United States has also been unable to solve three other major foreign policy problems. Washington has worked overtime with no success to shut down Iran's uranium enrichment capability for fear that it might lead to Tehran acquiring nuclear weapons. And the United States, unable to prevent North Korea from acquiring nuclear weapons in the first place, now seems incapable of compelling Pyongyang to give them up. Finally, every post-Cold War administration has tried and failed to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All indicators are that this problem will deteriorate further as the West Bank and Gaza are incorporated into a greater Israel. The unpleasant truth is that the United States is in a world of trouble today on the foreign policy front, and this state of affairs is only likely to get worse in the next few years as Afghanistan and Iraq unravel and the blame game escalates to poisonous levels. So we're losing the wars, we're losing the foreign policy battles, and it's likely to get worse. What would it take? Would it take a miracle to turn things around, or do you have an idea that doesn't depend on that much divine intervention?
I think the only thing that will turn it around is continued deterioration of the American economy and clear losses in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. To put it bluntly, failure is the only thing that will turn this around.
Yeah, that is very frightening. And John, I just want to say, first of all, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you on our show. Secondly, everybody should be, we have a direct link to this article that you wrote at the National Interest. We have a direct link to that at the front page of our website. And people should definitely read this article. It is amazing. It will really open your eyes and make you think a lot about the war on terror. John Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His most recent book, again, is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in Politics. That's published on Oxford University Press. And if you go to our website, just click on the words Oxford University Press. It takes you directly to a page where you can purchase the book from the publisher. One last question for you, John, and it's our question from hell, the question that you may hate to answer, we may hate to ask, or I think in this case, our audience is going to be very disturbed by the response. This week, the tensions between Israel and Turkey have been growing. Turkey is upset that Israel has not taken responsibility for or apologized for the Gaza flotilla raid last year that left 9 activists dead, including 8 Turks. One UN panel said the Israeli blockade of Gaza was legal. Then a UN panel came out and said the Gaza flotilla raid was illegal. The Turkish prime minister said that the raid was a cause for war, but that Turkey was showing patience. Then the Turkish prime minister said that Turkish warships may escort the next Gaza flotilla. I saw very little of this on American national network or cable news until Friday when CNN reported on this story with the headline. This is the headline that was on the screen. Obama facing trouble with Palestinian UN statehood vote. What do we miss in our understanding of the tensions in the Middle East, the problems and conflicts in the Middle East, when they are seen through a lens of American domestic politics?
Well, Chuck, as you know, Steve Walt and I wrote this article entitled The Israel Lobby, which then was turned into a book called The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And our basic thesis in that book is that the Israel Lobby has a profound influence on U.S. Middle East policy. And we also note in that book that the lobby goes to enormous lengths here in the United States and in the West more generally to dominate the discourse about Israel, especially in the mainstream media. In other words, the Israel lobby wants to make sure that the mainstream media is not in any way critical of Israel and always tells the story about Middle East politics from the Israeli point of view. And of course, the lobby is very successful on that front. And the end result is that we have a distorted discourse about Middle East politics, especially about U.S.-Israeli relations and about Israeli policy in the Middle East. So anyone who pays attention to the mainstream media to get their information about what's going on in the Middle East is going to end up thinking about that area of the world and thinking about how Washington relates to it in wrong-headed ways. And what you really want to do is you want to go to the internet, and you are much better off going to newspapers like Haaretz, which is the New York Times of Israel, and the Jerusalem Post, which is a very hawkish paper, by the way, and reading what they have to say about U.S.-Israeli relations, about Israeli policy, and more generally about what's going on in the Middle East. Because on the internet, there's a much richer discourse about Israel and the United States. But the mainstream media is really rather pathetic. And the end result of this, I'm sad to say, is that most, but not all Americans, have a distorted view of what's going on in that very important region of the world.
John, again, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on our show this morning. Now that I have your email address, you can count on the fact that I'll be bugging you in the future to get you back on. I really appreciate you being on our show this morning. This has been an amazing conversation. And enjoy the rest of your fall. There's only 3 days left.
Thank you, Chuck, and thanks for having me on.
All right, take care, John.